with him. "Ship's more than she looks like," he observed. "Cleaner than a few of the hulks I've worked on, too." "We run a tight ship," Edvard said nonchalantly. "My boss has his standards."
"So he does," the pirate allowed.
"We have 10 pods for you. Each contains 4 upgrade kits for a cataphract fighter. And unless I misread the specs, 9/10 of the mass and volume is a replacement positron lance. Your flyboys are going to be happy."
"I look forward to seeing..."
"Shit!" Henry exclaimed, holding up his hand as his eyes glazed slightly, the expression of someone linked in to their implant communicator.
"Son of a fucking Martian!"
"What the hell?" Edvard demanded, but the pirate spun to look at him.
"You've got more people than you're showing," he said.
It wasn't a question.
"Battle armor, weapons, marines, right?"
"Maybe."
"One of the boss's lieutenants just decided that right fucking now is the best opportunity he can find to make a play. And he sees your ship as a bonus. You've got 100 guys swarming this way, half in battle armor."
"I can handle that," Edvard said grimly, sending notes to his platoon leaders.
"Can you pull my boss out?"
Henry said flatly.
"I got a warning from one of the guys I trust. Then I lost comms with the station."
He swallowed.
"I'm authorized to offer 10 million Terran dollars for assistance in this case."
"Let me deal with the borders first," the Marine said grimly. "But then I have to go in after my boss, too."
"Launch! Launch! Launch!"
Russell's voice echoed over both the implant network and in the cockpit of his starfighter as he barked the order. No one was quite sure what was going on yet, but they'd lost communications with the captain and Glass at the same time that Edvard's new friend had lost contact with the station. Whatever the situation was, however, Russell was more confident in their ability to handle it with 40 starfighters in space. A giant's palm slammed him back into his acceleration couch as the Q-ship fired his ship into space. With every mass manipulator on his ship dedicated to countering the force, it was survivable, but they could only absorb 99.9% of the over 20,000 gravities he was subjected to for a fraction of a second.
"Alpha Squadron clear,"
Flight Commander Churchill reported.
"And accessories."
"I heard that,"
Russell snapped back at his subordinate. Those accessories were his starfighter and the first of the black starfighters from his Echo Squadron.
"Second cycle in 10 seconds, his deck chief reported. "Clear the airspace, people."
Russell engaged his link with the starfighter. His implant kicked into a new gear, and suddenly he was the agile 4,000-ton starfighter. A moment's thought brought the antimatter engines to life, moving his ship out of the path of the next wave of starfighters, and bringing his weapons to bear on one of the 2 defensive platforms trailing Judeca Station.
"Cag, you have incoming missiles," Chownik reported. "Both stations just launched. I'm reading a 12 capital ship missiles from each of them. We're trying to clear the gun ports, but scans show someone mounted explosives on the cargo tunnel. If I break free to maneuver, I'll blow a big enough hole in the side that we won't need a carrier deck,"
the Exo told him grimly.
"Missile defense is in play, but unless someone flies in front of our big guns, this isn't going to be Chameleon's fight. I've got 1 missile salvo. Let me know if you see a use for it."
"Will do,"
Russell said distractedly, studying the incoming missiles and the stations behind them.
"Alpha Squadron, take those lead missiles. Cover Chameleon," he ordered. "Bravo Squadron, form on me as you emerge. We're going after those launch platforms."
"Wilco,"
Churchill replied. Moments later, all 8 of Alpha Squadron's cataphracts charged forward at 480 gravities. Not what the Falcons they were used to could achieve, but still more than the unupgraded cataphract was capable of. Bravo Squadron and 2 more of Echo's fighters were accelerating to catch up with Russell as he held his own acceleration down, studying the ice-encased weapons platform he designated as Target Alpha. It was hard to say just how large the actual platform was with the ice wrapped around it. The entire ice ball was a rough egg, 200 meters long and 150 wide, but at least a few meters of that had to be ice. They were hitting it with active radar now, which wasn't helping as much as he'd like. The pirates had crammed 12 capital ship launchers into the thing. Even if there was only a meter of ice on each side, the platform wasn't big enough for more than a handful of small lances and maybe 2 good-sized ones. the two platforms had to be primarily missile bases, which meant that they were a bigger threat to Chameleon than his starfighters. Even the cataphracts were going to eat the stations alive, which meant there had to be starfighters somewhere, as he doubted someone with Trickster's reputation would have missed the shortfall. His attention was broken by the rippling explosions of failing containment on antimatter warheads. With Target Alpha only 80,000 kilometers from Chameleon, and Target Bravo only 100,000 kilometers farther away, Churchill's squadron had started in range of the missiles. The weapons might be smart and maneuverable, but they weren't that capable. The salvo from Target Alpha came apart in a series of 1 gigaton explosions as they ran into Alpha Squadron's positron lances, and Russell smiled mirthlessly. He was even less sure of the station's defenses than of its weapons, but at 50,000 kilometers, his people had a decent chance of burning through its deflectors for a hit. Charlie Squadron was out behind him now, and once Alpha Squadron had finished shredding Target Alpha's missiles, they could move on to Bravo's. Wait.
Guns, what the hell are Target Bravo's missiles doing?
He demanded of Alvarado. Even as he was noticing the change in Bravo's missiles' path, so was Target Alpha. The weapons platform had so far been relatively quiet other than launching the missiles, but it sprang to life as Target Bravo's missiles charged toward it, not past it. Lasers and defensive positron lances flared to life in flashes of vaporizing ice, but Bravo's commander had timed the change in their missiles' course perfectly. There wasn't enough time for Alpha to shoot down all of them. There was, apparently, enough time to fire Alpha's main weapon, though. In the moments before the surviving trio of missiles impacted, a megaton-per-second capital ship-grade positron lance flared to life, connecting the two platforms with a beam of pure antimatter. Both platforms vanished in near-simultaneous explosions, vaporized ice and metal flaring out in every direction.
"Well, that'll make things easier," Churchill noted. "I'm guessing some of our friends don't like each other much."
"What the hell have we stumbled into the middle of?"
Russell asked aloud.
"I don't know," Chownik interrupted. "But we're not done yet. Judeca Station's weapons aren't online yet, but we're running active pulses and picking. Son of a bitch!"
Everyone's sensors were suddenly overwhelmed with a brilliant flash of Cherenkov radiation as a starship emerged from Alcubierre Drive, barely 2 light seconds away. It took Edvard a moment to realize what he was seeing after the massive door at the other end of the cargo tunnel slid open again. Something was moving forward, but it wasn't armored troopers. The incoming things were each about a meter high, 4-legged, and armed.
"Combat drones!" he finally realized aloud. "Stand by to take them out!"
He glanced over at Henry. Trickster's people had joined his in taking cover as they prepared to defend the cargo bay.
"Please tell me those are remote-controlled," he said calmly.
Fully autonomous war machines were banned by treaties and agreements dating back to pre-Alcubierre Earth, and the occasional secret project by various governments tended to blow up sufficiently to keep those treaties honored.
"No," the pirate admitted. "Fully self-directed. Supposed to ignore people who are unarmed or wearing a certain badge, but... well, let's just say these ones ended up in a black marketer's inventory for a reason. Usually just the threat is enough to get a ship that's being stubborn to surrender," he added. "Boss only actually used them once that I know, on the dictator's people."
"No wonder he hates your guts," Edvard muttered.
"Any particular weak points?"
"The override codes?"
Henry grunted.
"Which I tried 10 seconds ago. They've either taken out the three I know or just outright disabled the override. Bastards."
From the sound of it, disabling the overrides turned the drone into an area denial weapon. They'd probably shoot at anyone they saw.
"Great,"
Edvard replied, watching the distance drop. He doubted the pirates had sent the drones unless they had some way of getting through Chameleon's hull.
"Commander,"
he raised Chownik,
"how are we doing with those explosives?"
"Chief Radnick says he's just disabled the remote detonators,"
the XO replied, a distinct tone of relief in his voice.
"The pressure detonators are still in place, so we're not going anywhere, but they aren't going to have any luck blasting their way in, either."
"Then I guess we'll have to let them knock," Edvard said calmly. "If the captain wasn't in there,
I wouldn't let them do more.
You have a plan, Elmage?
Yes, sir.
Then go get our captain back.
Wilco, Edvard replied with a grin, turning his attention back to the cargo tunnel linking the two ships. The drones were almost to the access to Chameleon, and he could see people starting to move in the station itself. At least some were in battle armor, though it didn't look like all or even a majority.
Door opens in 10 seconds, he barked. Pick your targets. Put down those fucking drones, then assault the station. These bastards have no clue what it means to deal with Castle's damned marines.
A yipping wolf howl echoed from the speakers on his marines' battle armor, and then the door slammed open, exposing the incoming robots to their fire. The robots might be fast and self-directed, but they couldn't scan and target through starship armor. The marines, however, had access to the pickups on the outside of their ship. They'd already picked their targets before Edvard hit the command to open the door, and he had 200 marines and Black Ops troopers, plus 24 of Henry's people, targeting barely 100 drones. Henry had clearly thought the drones were tough, a credible threat, but Edvard's people were firing tungsten penetrators designed to take down battle armor, and each drone was hit by at least 6 of them. Moments after the door opened, his howling marines charged over the junkyard that had been the pirates' first wave.
Chapter 19. New Edmonton System. 0815, May 27th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Giudecca Station, Ice Belt. Jose blocked the door for a long moment, his shattered corpse still sufficient to stop a spray of bullets from reaching the room. As his immense form finally fell, a security shutter slammed down to seal the room away.
We're being jammed,
Kyle told Glass after an abortive attempt to reach Chameleon.
What's going on? He demanded of Trickster.
The pirate was busy opening a concealed locker in the wall and pulling out weapons.
They're jamming you because I just shut down Giudecca Station's defenses to be safe, they said calmly. I think I managed to ping people I believe are loyal on the defense platforms as well, which should stop their weapons being turned on your ship.
Why my ship? Kyle demanded.
Because up until the moment you demonstrated that your ship had at least one fully functioning, military-grade fighter launch tube, no one in this system except me and presumably whoever you met on Station 6 knew your ship was a Q-ship,
Trickster said flatly.
Which makes her the most valuable prize any pirate can think of.
Well, except me, they noted after a moment. I can think of a more valuable prize, my life and my fleet, which I wouldn't expect to survive a stupid attempt to seize a properly crewed Q-ship.
Glass looked vaguely sick, probably realizing that his attempt to have Cavendish contact Trickster quietly had created even more problems than he'd known.
So, your people are trying to kill us to steal our ship? The spy asked slowly.
No,
Trickster replied with a bark of laughter.
They're trying to kill me today because your ship makes a nice bonus. They're trying to kill me to take over, since they think Periklos will turn a blind eye to our little operation once I'm dead, which he won't.
The pirate tossed a pair of weapons onto the desk.
Glass, I know you can shoot. Roberts?
I'm no marine, but I can shoot, the big captain said grimly.
These are Commonwealth Presidential Protection Detail anti-armor carbines, the pirate noted. They're recoilless, so watch the fucking vent, but fire the same tungsten penetrator their marine battle armor rifles use.
Kyle took the carbine and studied it carefully, making sure he was clear of the vent that would spew superheated gas while firing. His ship suit would absorb most of the heat from it, but even with it, he suspected firing a battle armor equivalent weapon was going to get warm.
In about a minute, Raynor's men are going to realize that shutter is made of old-style neutronium armor, and nothing they have is getting through it, the pirate told them.
Unfortunately, the rest of the room is not, so they're going to come through the walls. Trickster kicked over their desk and gestured for them to take cover behind it with them.
Who's Raynor?
Captain of my best ship, the ungrateful bastard, Trickster replied. Also, the only one of my people with the spine to even try this.
Is his ship here?
If it isn't yet, it will be. I hope your people are ready to fight.
They are, Kyle confirmed. We were expecting you to betray us.
Trickster chuckled.
I won't deny I thought about it, but the last people who tried to betray Mr. Glass here ended up with their entire station dropped into a gas giant.
Kyle glanced over at Glass, who shrugged and then pointed.
They're about to come through there, he said calmly.
The desk was pointed in roughly the right direction, allowing Kyle to train the carbine on the wall the spy had indicated. He couldn't see anything, but he knew Glass had a higher level of augmentation than he did. A few seconds later, his faith in the spy was vindicated as the wall exploded, shards of rock, ice, and metal spraying across the room and slamming into the desk. Despite the furniture's apparent plainness, it clearly had been designed with this exact purpose in mind, as nothing made it through.
And now, Glass snapped.
Kyle rose over the desk and opened fire along with the other two men, filling the still steaming hole with hypervelocity penetrators. A man in battle armor appeared to be leading the way, but half a dozen rounds punched clean through his armor and he collapsed to his knees, adding to the debris the explosion had created. Return fire flared in the smoke, bullets ricocheting off of the desk as Kyle dropped behind it again, firing blindly over the top of it. Bullets flew both ways for a few seconds, until Trickster attached a cylinder they'd removed from the locker to the top of their carbine, lifted it over the desk, and triggered it. Heat washed over Kyle, even more than the venting gas from the anti-armor carbine, and then the entire room shook as something exploded in the tunnel. Silence followed.
I only have one more of those, Trickster said conversationally. Am I safe in presuming your Marines are going to come rescue you?
What would your plan be if they weren't? Kyle asked.
Escape tunnel, one-man shuttle, suicide charge, wait for pickup.
The pirate reeled off instantly.
Since that would involve leaving you and Glass behind and probably destroying your ship, I'm hoping you have an alternative.
I've got hoplites on the screen, Alvarado snapped. No launchers, they're just opening the hatch and dumping them out.
Old-fashioned pirates, the CAG said grimly. Please tell me everyone's in space.
Everyone's in space, the lieutenant confirmed.
All squadrons, listen in, Russell ordered. Alpha, Charlie, Delta, jump those fighters before they get themselves sorted out. Bravo, Echo, we're going after the ship. Launch missiles as soon as you have a clear shot.
Fitting his actions to his words, he lined the nose of his cataphract up with the new freighter. He didn't know how many starfighters the pirates had shoved into her, but every starfighter that was still aboard her when she went up was one they weren't going to have to fight. Whoever had jumped her in probably hadn't been expecting to find the space around Judeca Station swarming with starfighters. As soon as the nose of his bird lined up with the ship, he fired his positron lance, hoping that the ship only had civilian deflectors. That was clearly not the case, as his antimatter beam was ripped to shreds, its particles scattered around the freighter in a pattern that was almost pretty, but definitely wasn't lethal.
Missiles away,
Alvarado reported calmly.
Clean and running true. Flight time?
The man sighed.
Flight time is over 2 minutes. They're going to get their birds out, boss.
We'll deal with them, he said grimly.
The rest of his two designated squadrons were launching as well. 32 missiles wasn't much of a salvo, especially when spread out like this.
Bravo, Echo. Network in for synchronized launches. Empty the magazines and engage their starfighters with lances. Everyone else, missiles free. Take down those hoplites.
More of the Sarissa starfighter missiles blazed free of his fighters, filling the space around them with the tiny suns of antimatter fire as 80 more missiles blasted into space. 10 seconds later, another 80 missiles joined them. The hoplites had started to launch missiles as well, their inferior numbers made up by the fact they carried twice as many launchers as his people.
I'm reading 24 hoplites, his gunner reported. I'm not seeing any new launches, and the freighter is turning to run. She's got to be armed, right?
Not heavily, Russell murmured. How much firepower do you need to intimidate merchant ships? Ride the missiles, guns.
I'm taking us after their birds.
Part of his mind was watching the entire battle. His people had the pirates outnumbered by almost 2-1, but the Hoplite was a superior fighter in every sense. More launchers, a more powerful lance, better engines, better ECM. But his own ships had been upgraded as much as they could without the League-designed upgrade kits they'd come there to buy. They were faster than the pirates were expecting, with better ECM, and his pilots were veterans of the bloody campaign 7th Fleet had waged against the Commonwealth earlier that year. Missiles started to explode as his people's lances and defensive laser suites cut into the incoming fire. The explosions expanded, rippling into secondary explosions that lit up the sky. Had the pirates not dispersed their salvo? They hadn't, but there had also been method to their madness. The explosions of the clusters blinded sensors, forcing his fighters to cease firing for precious seconds in which the unclustered missiles closed thousands of kilometers. He threw his fighter into a 90-degree turn, building a vector away from where the missiles saw him. It didn't buy him a lot of time, but it bought enough for his laser suite to blow the missile apart while it was still a dozen kilometers away. Not all of his people were as lucky. Alpha Squadron was closest, and those fractions of a second made all of the difference. Three of Churchill's starfighters disappeared, and the cataphracts lacked the escape pods the Federation had always built into their craft. Nine of Rokos's people had just died, their bodies vaporized in antimatter fire. Their own missiles fell on the pirates at the same time. The first salvo, launched at the pirate freighter, arrived first. The ship did have some defenses. Several suites of anti-missile laser turrets opened fire as the missiles closed, but not nearly enough. Over a dozen of that first salvo made it through, obliterating the pirate ship in a massive fireball that rendered about 60 missiles Russell's people had fired into useless navigational hazards. There were failsafes for that, though, and he turned his attention back to the hoplites. Their heavier lances and deflectors meant they outranged his people, but it didn't look like it was going to matter. His people were integrating their ECM, random walking illusions of an additional 100 starfighters in the space around them, and they'd still lost 3 starfighters. The hoplite crews weren't trained in that. Each of them was running their own ECM with integration or coordination, resulting in a hellacious mess, one that the humans guiding the Federation missiles could see the individual spheres of. It wasn't quite as simple as guiding the missiles into the center of those spheres, but the lack of coordination cost the hoplites a massive amount of their effectiveness, and Russell's people had sent them 12 missiles each. The remaining pirate salvos killed 2 more cataphracts and 6 more of his people, but not one of the pirate starfighters made it out intact. The Marines made it over halfway through the cargo tunnel before the pirates even realized they were facing a counterattack. If there had been cover, Edvard's people would have used thrusters and magnet boots to account for the lack of gravity, but since there was no cover to be found, they instead used that lack to launch themselves down the tunnel like miniature spaceships. Scanners in the battle armor suits fed their data to a carefully linked network, all of it feeding back to the lieutenants and to Edvard Hansen, who reviewed it in his implant as he charged forward with the rest of his Marines. "Riley, take your people and hit the left gallery," he ordered, highlighting a section where a group of pirates were carrying tripod-mounted anti-armor rifles, the most likely man-portable gear to threaten his armored Marines. "Tan, hit the armor contingent. Grenades, full auto, sweep them out," he instructed his Alpha platoon commander, highlighting the middle of Judeca Station's cargo bay, where the platoon's worth or so of pirates with actual battle armor had gathered. "Daniels, clean up in between. Prioritize anyone who looks to have anti-armor gear. HQ section, follow me," he finished grimly. "We're punching straight through into the station."
"Do we know where we're going?"
someone asked.
"I've got coordinates for the captain's last known location," Edvard replied. "I figure we start there and shoot our way out. Now go!"
The shooting had already started. The pirates clearly hadn't been expecting Marines, as a number of even their battle-armored soldiers carried lower-velocity weapons, lacking the penetration to threaten his people. Enough had real guns that the trip through the cargo tunnel couldn't be fast enough for all of his people to survive. Suppressing fire hammered their destination, shattering cargo containers, armor, and pirates alike, but their return fire was equally intense, and the Marines had no cover. Flashing alerts appeared on his implant feed, warning him that he was losing people. Edvard's own rifle jerked with a recoil that could easily have thrown him back down the tunnel, walking high-caliber explosive rounds across the room. A spray of fire from one of the miniguns the armored pirate troopers carried walked across his armor, the bullets shoving him backward even as they failed to penetrate his armor. His suit computer highlighted the source, and Edvard sent a burst of penetrators back at the pirate. The heavy rounds punched clean through the armor suit, sending the other man crumpling backward just as Edvard finally reached Judeca Station's gravity and slammed heavily into the metal flooring. His neural implant coldly informed him that 23 of his people had been wounded or killed in the process of crossing the tunnel, and they'd turned the station's cargo bay into a scene from hell. At least one of the pods had been a fuel container of some kind, and it had managed to get spread around before it ignited. The pirates who'd gathered to attack Chameleon would never attack anyone again. If any of them were still alive, they were choosing to pretend to be dead, and Edvard was perfectly willing to let them. "Tan, secure the cargo bay," he ordered quietly. "If any of them are still alive, keep them that way. Daniels, sweep the station perimeter. Remember, some people on here might still be on our side. Give them a chance to drop their guns before you put them down, but don't let anyone with anti-armor gear take a shot. Riley, you're with me in the HQ section. Move out!" The station was a mess. Without a guide, Edvard's strike force was restricted to guessing corridors and occasionally blasting through floors, a process that met with disturbingly little resistance, primarily because everyone they came across was dead. Charging through Judeca Station felt like sweeping a battlefield for survivors. At some point after their arrival, a significant chunk of the people aboard the station had turned on the rest. Being a pirate station, however, everyone had been armed, and it had turned into a vicious multi-way melee. A melee that his Marines had arrived too late to change the course of. The eerie silence of the station eventually faded into the distant sound of gunfire as they approached Captain Roberts' last coordinates. The corridors here were narrower, dirtier, intentionally designed to limit an attacker's approach room. They were still big enough for battle armor, though, and he pushed on toward the sound of the guns. The platoon's networked computers assessed distance from the volume and Doppler shifts and warned them as they reached the point of no return. "You don't lead," Riley told him flatly as he started forward. "You know better." He made a small acceding gesture. He hadn't quite intended to go first, but she was right that he needed to be farther back. "Go," he ordered softly. Two of the armored Black Ops troopers moved forward, their armor suddenly much quieter as they engaged a sound-deadening function his Marines' gear lacked. Cameras in their helmets relayed what they saw back to him and Riley. Any remnant of the original structure of the space the point men could see was long gone now. Explosives and vibroblades had gutted walls and dug new tunnels through the ice, wrapping around an armored capsule that had clearly been cut open twice, and both entrances collapsed by explosives. An entire side of the room had now been blasted off, and gunfire echoed into and out of the space. The fire coming from inside was far heavier than Edvard would have expected from three people with hand weapons, and there were enough suits of battle armor among the dead scattered through the debris to suggest the attackers had underestimated Trickster's armament supply. There weren't many of them left now. From the bodies, they'd started with over 100 people, a third in battle armor. Now they were down to barely 20, and Edvard was behind them with over 60. "Take them!" he snapped. More of his people charged out of the tunnels behind the point team. The lead two Black Ops troopers opened fire first, carefully targeted bursts cutting down the last few survivors in battle armor and ending any chance the pirates had before the fight truly began. Gunfire continued to echo out of the capsule once it was over, suppressing fire to keep everyone's heads down. Despite everything, the jamming was still up. While Edvard had contact with his strike force by relayed microbeams, he had no communications with his other platoons that were hopefully securing the station. Instead, he approached as close as he could and brought up the loudspeakers.
Captain Roberts, it's Lieutenant Major Hansen. We've secured the exterior, if you'd like to stop shooting.
How do we know it's you?
A quavering voice he recognized as belonging to the spy, Glass. Tell Roberts he owes me a beer for saving his ass.
It's Hansen, Roberts proclaimed. I'll pay up gladly.
Stepping around and into the field of view, Edvard marveled at the state of the office. It looked like every piece of furniture had been used as cover for an impromptu fort, as the room itself had disintegrated around them, and that every piece of furniture had been built to use as cover. Glass was leaning on the dented remains of a bookshelf, breathing heavily as he released the two propped carbines he'd been keeping up the suppressive fire with. Behind him, the massive form of Captain Roberts rose from the ground, supporting a masked stranger.
I will be fine, Captain Roberts, the stranger said in a voice clearly running through computer modulation. Lieutenant Major Hansen, are you in contact with any of my people?
I left Henry and your cargo team aboard Chameleon, Edvard told him. They didn't have the armor for the fight that was coming. I haven't encountered anyone else alive who didn't shoot at us.
Damn, Trickster said mildly. I owe your people, but I wish I could contact more of mine. The jamming?
I have two platoons securing the station. They'll take it down once they find it, Edvard promised.
Thank you, Lieutenant Major, Captain Roberts.
Glass, Trickster told them, carefully removing their weight from Roberts. They held out a data stick to Glass.
I believe, Mr. Glass, that you can keep this. The payment for your cargo has been rendered in full.
Chapter 20. New Edmonton System. 10:15, May 27th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon, Ice Belt.
We have a problem, sir,
Chownik reported as Kyle finally re-entered his bridge. Somehow, Kyle was not surprised. Today wouldn't be complete without more problems.
What have we got?
He asked, dropping into the command chair and wincing as he jarred his arm. He hadn't been badly wounded, just a gouge across the bicep, but the field dressing Hansen's people had shoved on it had left his arm tender. If Trickster had been one iota less paranoid, all three of them would have died in that office.
I've got what looks like a condottieri carrier heading our way, his XO explained, flipping Kyle an implant feed and highlighting the ship in question. She isn't super modern or super large, but she's at least 40 million cubic meters and heading our way at 200 gravities. I'd be surprised if she has less than 150 fighters aboard.
ETA?
12 hours, so she isn't an immediate issue, Chownik replied. Just something you needed to be aware of.
Agreed, Kyle told him. Let me check with our friend.
With the jamming finally down, Trickster had remained on the station as one of Hansen's platoons finished sweeping the base for the remaining mutineers. Judeca had had a population of just over 1,800. From the sounds of it, Trickster had less than 200 people left. Kyle pinged Glass first.
We have incoming, he told the spy. Condottieri warship. She's still 12 hours out, but I'm guessing they won't be happy with Trickster.
Heraklos put enough of a bounty on Trickster to buy someone a new starship, Glass said flatly. God alone knows how he's going to pay for it, but that's a good chunk of the annual budget of many of the League's system governments. Trickster can't be here when they get here, and neither can we, Roberts.
How much of a favor do we owe them?
Not that big, the spy replied. If Trickster wants a ride to another star system, and it's not out of our way, their goodwill is probably still going to be worth something going forward, but...
Understood, Kyle confirmed. Let's see what they say.
He linked into the radio channel they were maintaining with Judeca Station.
Get me Trickster, he ordered the pirate who answered the comm.
He was apparently high on the pirate's list of people they were willing to talk to, as their androgynous voice was on the channel less than 10 seconds later.
Roberts, is this you telling me you're leaving us?
Not yet, but pretty quickly, Kyle told them. There's a condottieri carrier headed this way.
and the gods know Chameleon can't fight a real warship. And, no offense, I'm not going to try for you. Enough of his people had died because of the pirate as it was.
Won't ask you to,
Trickster confirmed.
In fact, they paused, if you come about 93 degrees in the ecliptic and angle up 26 and wait about 10 minutes, I think I can give you some cover for your withdrawal.
I'd appreciate it, Kyle admitted with a sigh.
I owe you, Captain Roberts, the pirate told him. I'll find a way to repay you, sooner or later.
I might hold you to that, he replied.
Just don't rely on it,
Trickster said with a chuckle. I didn't earn my name by keeping all my promises, after all. Hit that vector, Captain,
and watch for the fireworks.
Shaking his head, Kyle cut the channel and flipped the vector to Lau. As soon as Hansen's people are back aboard, set on this course and prepare our Alcubierre jump. Destination is one light month short of the Aurelius system. Lau nodded silently, but Kyle was already raising Hansen. Elmage, pull your people off the station, he told the Marine. We are leaving New Edmonton.
Understood, Hansen replied. Should be good to go. Give me 5 minutes.
You have three. I don't think the station's going to be here in 10.
On our way.
Hansen's people didn't make Kyle's 3-minute deadline, but were still out before the 5 minutes were up, their shuttle chasing after Chameleon as the Q-ship accelerated away on the course Trickster had given them. With several hundred gravities more acceleration than its mothership, the shuttle had almost caught up by the time Trickster's 10-minute limit had passed. Kyle turned his attention to Judeca Station, expecting a show. For a few moments, there was nothing. The shuttle grew nearer. The far-off Condottieri carrier continued to approach. The ice-wrapped station continued in its orbit, its exterior unmarred by the violence that had swept its interior. Kyle was watching carefully, so he saw the blip as something happened, and then the station broke apart. 5 major pieces drifted apart, chunks of metal and ice severed apart by clearly pre-positioned explosives.
Jump? Lau asked.
No, he said softly. Prep the Stetson fields, though. Bring them up as soon as the Marines are aboard.
Seconds ticked by, and the assault shuttle charged into the cover of the big starship.
Marine shuttle inside the safety zone, Chownik reported.
Fields up, singularities on standby, the navigator reported crisply.
Shouldn't there be some kind of light show? Kyle's XO asked.
And now, Kyle replied with a grin. On the screen in front of him, strings of antimatter bomblets that had been strung between the chunks of the station lit up, dozens of multi-megaton annihilations lighting up space.
Go, he ordered.
The first chunk of station went up in a 50-gigaton antimatter explosion, and then the New Edmonton system disappeared in the distinctive twist of reality warped beyond tolerance. A few moments later, the standard computer-generated image of the stars replaced the incomprehensible mess of light the Alcubierre drive left them with. For obvious reasons, it lacked any updated presentation of Judeca Station.
We were watching closely, Kyle said softly. Did we pick up Trickster's ship leaving?
There was a ship? Chownik asked.
They weren't going to go up with their space station, the captain pointed out. Commander Taylor, did we get anything?
Smallest FTL ship I ever saw, she said after a moment. The chunk closest to us was ice wrapped around a starship about 200 meters long. Her Alcubierre Stetson drive lit off with the first explosions. We were less than a light second away, and we barely picked her out.
So, as far as Dictator Periklos's people are concerned, Trickster's probably dead, Kyle noted. Probably for the best, for now.
He glanced around his bridge.
Good work, everyone, he rumbled loudly. I have to admit to an extra appreciation for your efforts to pull my own personal ass out of the fire.
Chuckles responded, but he continued more somberly. We'll sort out a memorial for the Marines and flight crew we lost today before we're too far on our way, he reminded them. We have a mission to complete,
but we won't forget our fallen, either.
2 hours after a combat engagement, the flight deck was a hive of activity. Maintenance teams swept over each fighter in sequence, running system tests, cleaning vents, opening panels, and going through every step of the massive checklists required to be 110% certain no part of the deadly spacecraft had been damaged or misaligned. While the maintenance crews did their magic, Russell's flight crews were either asleep, recovering from the inevitable adrenaline crash, or getting very drunk. Alcohol was rarely to his taste, and sleep would be a long time coming. There was, after all, a very quiet section of the hangar that had held half of Alpha Squadron's fighters this morning. If there was anything the maintenance staff needed from those four hangars, they were finding it somewhere else and leaving the CAG alone with his thoughts. It was strange. Russell had lost people under his command before. He'd been a squadron commander at Tranquility when the old Avalon's fighter group had been gutted along with their carrier home. He'd seen fighter wings absolutely destroyed. The wing he'd escorted the rescue transports out of Hui Xing with had ended up being most of the surviving starfighters from the entire four-starship battle group. And yet, those four empty fighter stalls and the one over in Echo Squadron's section of the flight deck hit him harder than any of those losses. He might have lost people under his command, but he had never lost people while in command. There was no one else to offload responsibility onto. No one else who could have been smarter, faster. He'd commanded the entire fighter strike, and he'd lost an eighth of his starfighters and 15 people doing it. Intellectually, he knew he'd gone up against starfighters with a terrifying individual superiority at point-blank range, with no chance for either side to truly grasp what kind of fight they were getting into. Only losing five fighters against an arguably superior force was a decent job. Once they'd finished upgrading his ships, combining the D-mod kits and his own people's adjustments, they'd easily have added 500 tons to the starfighter's mass, but almost doubled their lethality. The hoplites would still have been superior, but not as much. The problem was that they'd be fighting Katanas, the Terran's new seventh-generation starfighters. Those were going to dance rings around his upgraded cataphracts, and he didn't see a solution for that. Turning to leave, he spotted Flight Commander Laura Cavendish standing in front of the empty hangar that had held Echo 6. She wore a plain black ship suit without insignia, by choice, as she had every right to her uniform. She just wasn't cleared to fly. He wasn't sure what impulse carried him over to her, but he wasn't nearly stealthy enough to sneak up on her. Cavendish turned as he was approaching her, and her eyes flashed at the sight of him.
"Are you happy now?"
she demanded, gesturing to the empty hangar behind her.
"I flew with Carter for 5 years. Devine and Cole backed her for 3. Gone. In an instant. Because you got a stick up your ass."
"I didn't know them," Russell admitted. "But I knew Flight Lieutenants Norma Boveri and Marius Knudsen and their crews more than in passing. I'd served with Flight Lieutenants Mai Nguyen and Felix Boss since before Tranquility. They were friends, and I'd met Nelly and her people. Do not dare assume that I do not know who they were," he hissed. "And before you accuse me of causing their deaths, perhaps you should talk to your boss? Because according to the briefing I got, this whole mess was triggered when one of Trickster's captains realized we were a Q-ship. Something no one in this system was aware of until you flew a starfighter without permission," he finished flatly. "I'm the CAG, so if you need to blame someone for their deaths, that's part of my job. But take the time to consider all the causes, Commander, because that's part of both our jobs."
Chapter 21. Deep Space. Under Alcubierre Drive. 1800, May 29th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Kyle shut down the file on his implant and leaned back in his chair, his eyes closed against the light in his office.
The butcher's bill had been far lower than they had any right to expect. The lack of escape pods on the cataphracts had taken its toll, but Hansen had only lost 26 Marines, all told, while taking a station with almost 2,000 residents. Tradition put the letter writing on Hansen and Rokos's subordinate officers as the direct superiors of the deceased. Tradition also said that the senior officers be available and willing to assist, all the way up to the ship's captain. Kyle was also determined to know, not merely have an implant storage, but know, the names of every man and woman who died under his command. The list was already far too long, but unless he resigned his commission today, there was no way to stop it. With a sigh, he cracked open another beer and took a long swallow. That was a thought that had rarely crossed his mind before Hui Xing. He couldn't actually resign, of course. The Federation was at war, and everyone was now in for the duration. But he could request a non-combat posting. It would be the end of his career. He'd never see another promotion and would certainly never see a command again. But he wouldn't have to send more men and women to their deaths. Would know, at least, that his screw-ups hadn't caused more deaths. Nothing he'd done could have changed the course of the fight at Judeca Station, though. They'd walked into a trap and fought their way back out of it, mostly because their enemy had underestimated them. Whether or not he'd stayed with Chameleon wouldn't have changed anything. Another sigh accompanied another swallow of beer, and he found himself studying the plaque of medals hung on the wall. 2 Federation Stars of Heroism, the second highest award the Castle Federation had for valor. The Tranquility Golden Crescent, that system's highest award for valor, awarded for turning back the Commonwealth assault at the start of the war. The Alazon Diamond Nova of Honor, given to him for almost accidentally liberating that system. His understanding was that he had more medals waiting for him if he ever returned to the Hui Xing or Free Het systems. The Coraline Imperium, the second-ranked power in the Alliance, had been making noises about the Imperator wanting to hang some chunk of rock on him personally for the rescue in Hui Xing. Kyle could remember how many people had died for each of those medals, from Ansem Gulf all the way to the Battle of Hui Xing. And yet, those pretty pieces of metal demonstrated that at least some people figured that he'd done better in those places than someone else would have. He finished the beer, his third of the evening, and glared at the medals. A ping on his implant interrupted his foul mood, informing him that he'd received a recorded message via QCOM from Mira Salas. That was odd. Mira commanded a capital ship. She should have been able to activate a live QCOM link to Chameleon, unless Cameroon was in an active combat zone. By the time he had that realization, he already had Mira's message and his lover's image filled the wall screen. She looked tired. Her uniform was still perfectly turned out. She didn't have a hair out of place, but he knew her well enough now to recognize it in the slump of her shoulders and the cast of her eyes.
"Hi, Kyle," she said quietly. "You're getting a recording because Hui Xing is being considered an active combat zone. Would rather see your face, but the rules are what they are, and they're right in any case. Commonwealth hit us 12 hours ago, trying to take out the ships we captured here before they could be repaired. 4 cruisers, 2 carriers, an entire fleet." She inhaled deeply and then let it go in a long sigh. "You'll see the formal report soon enough, same as everyone else, so I can actually tell you about it," she said. "I don't know where Command got the intel about the bastard's new starfighter, but it saved a lot of lives today. They were still flying scimitars off the cruisers and held back the katanas to lure us in. With the warning that the Terrans were rushing the new katanas to Walking Stick's fleets, the Admiral realized they hadn't launched the carrier fighters. She guessed what they were up to, and she guessed right," Mira continued. "They tried to mousetrap our fighters with the katanas, but we ran them in on a vector they could pull out on. If we hadn't," she shuddered. Our CAGs were expecting to run into scimitars with even numbers, which is to our benefit. With 3/4 of their fighters actually being katanas, it was bad enough.
We drove them off, obviously, she said quietly.
But we've been used to taking Terran starfighters less than seriously. That's going to have to change. The katana is a nasty piece of work. Same lance as a Phoenix Templar, she shivered. It's a fighter killer, and a hell of a lot better at the job than anything else they've built.
Kyle had reviewed the specifications Glass had forwarded back to the Alliance. The katana looked deadlier and sleeker than its purely cylindrical predecessor, trading missile capacity and a significantly increased mass for a hugely increased ECM capability and a single extremely powerful positron lance.
If we hadn't been expecting it, we might have lost Hui Xing, Mira admitted. As it was a pretty inconclusive slugfest. We took fighter losses and smashed the crap out of their new birds, but nobody lost starships.
They were testing the katanas, she concluded. I hate being Walking Stick's testbed.
With a shake of her head, she smiled at him.
I wanted to reach out before the official report started circulating, she told him. I'm fine, and Hui Xing's still ours. It could have been a lot worse.
She reached out to touch the camera recording her.
I know you can't tell me much about where you are and what you're doing, she said, but I hope it's going as smoothly as we can hope. I miss you.
The message ended, and Kyle considered the wall for a long moment. That intelligence had fallen into their hands by chance, though Ostrovsky had clearly known what it was going to be worth. Just that purchase alone had made their entire mission worthwhile. Breathing deeply, Kyle clasped his hands and smiled grimly. Maybe when this was over, he'd take that teaching position Kane had wanted him for and take a quiet few months to overcome his survivor's guilt. Today, however, his ship was 4 days from the Aurelius system, and despite his doubts and fears, he was in command. He owed his people his best, not his drunken misery.
Russell gestured Master Chief Petty Officer Adriana Hans to the seat across from his desk. The broad-shouldered, squat woman was frankly ugly. An accident with a superheated hydrogen fuel line early in her career had left the right side of her face a mess of scar tissue. But she'd come highly recommended by some of the best Space Force non-commissioned officers he knew. As the senior Space Force non-com aboard, Hans was the deck chief. She ran everything shipside for the Space Force, a role that often resulted in the senior NCO giving orders to the junior officers who flew the starfighters and ran the Navy logistics team that supported the deck.
You've had 2 days to look over the upgrade kits Trickster sold us, he said cheerfully. What do you think?
That anyone who thinks the League are unsophisticated needs to check their assumptions, Hans said flatly. Those kits are slick, sir. Upgrading a positron lance is a tricky business, but the kit is literally plug and play. The new mass manipulators just clamp onto the hull, which has to make tuning them a bitch, but the program they provide works like a charm.
The scarred woman shook her head.
Even the cataphract D is going to come off worse against a hoplite, she noted. But it's 1,500 tons lighter. What do you expect? The D model splits the difference on the lance power and matches the hoplite for acceleration and deflectors. Biggest shortfall remains 2 missile launchers to the hoplite's 4 and weaker ECM. Our EW software is better and makes up a chunk of the difference, but that kit really does turn the cataphract into an effective 6th-gen combatant.
I hope so, Russell replied. We're going to be taking them up against scimitars shortly, if we're lucky. You saw the specs on the katanas?
I did, Hans confirmed.
Your opinion?
If we run into katanas, we're fucked. The League hasn't managed to expand the 3rd acceleration plateau any better than anyone else has. Pretty much everyone is pulling 500 Gs now, but the katana has a much heavier lance and stronger deflectors. If you can't kill them in the missile pass, they'll shred you in lance range.
About what I was figuring, Russell agreed. I want you to take a look over the schematics. If you see anything you think I need to know from the technical side of either the D's or the katanas, let me know. Regardless, he continued, we need to get started on the upgrade kit installation. My understanding is that we'll be at our hold point for 2 days, waiting for a gap in the Terran's patrol schedule, but that still gives us less than a week to get 35 fighters upgraded.
Hans simply nodded and gestured to the wall screen.
May I, sir? She asked. I have a full schedule and upgrade plan ready to go if it works for you.
Russell blinked.
Okay, now he was impressed.
Show me, Chief.
L'chaim!
Edvard stood off to one side with his platoon lieutenants as the traditional toast echoed through the central chamber of the Marine barracks. He didn't even know what the toast meant, and he doubted any of his Marines or the Black Ops troopers did either. But it was the toast at the wake after they lost brothers and sisters in arms for the Castle Federation Marines, and the Black Ops troopers might not technically be Marines, but they were born from the same traditions. A dozen of the men and women in the room were still in casts and bandages, nanotech working away to heal their injuries to clear them for action. But tonight was about those who would never join them again. 26 empty chairs formed a closed circle in the center of the room, facing away from the gathering crowd. As he was the Marine commanding officer, tradition put Edvard in charge of a rather significant supply of approved beer and liquor, and he dipped into it heavily for tonight's wake. While he was sadly certain it wouldn't be the last time they'd lost people on this mission, it was the first time this company had been bloodied.
It's a good group, Riley said aloud. We fought and bled together now. Buys a bit of respect both ways with the Marines and my Black Ops guys.
I wish we'd had a better idea of how to use your people's skills, Edvard said quietly.
I don't see anywhere they could have done better, but your troopers have enough skills and tools my people don't that it seems almost wasteful to use them as part of the assault force.
Better than not using us, their commander replied. Judeca didn't exactly have an opportunity for us to stealth in and infiltrate subtly, after all. We're trained for assault, and to be honest, that's what we do most of the time, same as the Marines. We just do it in places the Senate doesn't like to admit we had people.
Setting up to infiltrate you guys would be hard, Edvard noted. Alcubierre Emergence isn't exactly quiet, after all.
Stealth requires making the bastards see what they expect instead of what's there, Riley told him. With a ship like Chameleon, it's easier than it might be. Write IFF code, a cargo shuttle. There's a reason we have some bog-standard Commonwealth-built cargo shuttles aboard. We can pull off a lot.
IFF codes only get us so far when everyone is announcing their arrival by QCOM, but that still gives me ideas.
Good, the lieutenant replied. Sometimes a frontal assault in battle armor is all we've got, sir. But, she gestured at the circle of chairs, I really don't like it.
Neither do I, Lieutenant Riley. Neither do I.
Russell woke up in the middle of the night to the eerie sensation of knowing someone was in his room. An implant command brought up the lights, and he found himself looking directly at Laura Cavendish, less than 50 centimeters from his bed. He even managed to have his hand on the gun in the bed's built-in holster before his brain caught up with the fact that she was naked.
What are you doing, Cavendish? He demanded, carefully controlling an overly enthused libido, and focusing his gaze above her right shoulder instead of her perky but probably not augmented chest. Thankfully, modern nanites came along with the ability to intentionally implement the effects of a cold shower without the shower. An effect she promptly undermined by grabbing his hand and placing it on her breast.
I've seen you looking at me, she whispered, and I want my command back. I think we can make a fair exchange, don't you?
Russell sighed and reclaimed his hand as swiftly as he could.
Get dressed, Commander, he ordered flatly. Firstly,
what you are suggesting is a violation of the Articles. Secondly, I don't know what you've seen, but I'm married and you're not my type. I prefer women I'm less likely to wake up knifed by the morning after, he finished dryly. Cavendish remained stubbornly naked, subtly adjusting her position in a way that was giving the nanites in his system the worst workout he remembered them having.
Commander. Laura, he conceded. Get dressed and have a seat.
She waited another 10 seconds as he silently stared over her shoulder, then sighed and slipped her ship suit back on.
What do you want? She demanded. To do my job and bring as many of my people home alive as I can, he told her. To do that, I need to trust the people under my command. None of your actions to date suggest that I can trust you, and this bullshit doesn't help your case.
The dark-haired woman was silent for several seconds. I've worked for Glass before, she said quietly, under his direct command. I don't know why he's trying to convince everyone in this mission that he's a civilian, but he's a Navy intelligence admiral and in my chain of command. It was as close to an apology as he was likely to actually get, and he gave her a short nod in acknowledgement.
He still isn't in your chain of command for this mission, he pointed out. And you disobeyed orders to return to base until we threatened to fire on you. And your stunt is why those pirates jumped at Judeca Station. I grounded you for a reason, Commander. You need to earn back my trust, and trying to seduce me is not the way to do it. Am I clear?
Somehow, he managed full command voice despite wearing a pair of shorts and sitting upright in his bed. With a swallow of air, Cavendish nodded her understanding.
Good. Now get out of my quarters, he ordered.
As the outer door to his rooms closed behind her, the CAG sighed and locked it with an implant command. He wasn't surprised to confirm that it had been locked. That just hadn't slowed Cavendish down. No wonder the Navy issue officer's bed came with a built-in holster. Chapter 22. Deep Space. 1 light month from Aurelius System. 1000, June 3rd, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon.
Stand by for fighter launch, Taylor announced into the quiet of Chameleon's bridge. Fighter wing deploying in 30 seconds.
Everyone aboard the bridge was linked into the same network, but the warning was still useful if someone was focusing on different tasks or, indeed, wasn't involved in the upcoming starfighter test at all. Kyle was paying attention to the test, but he was also reviewing the scans of the old light they were picking up from their target. Everything they saw out of Aurelius right now was a month out of date, but that didn't mean it was valueless. They now knew, for example, that Ostrovsky's information on the layout and position of the 7 space stations that made up the depot was completely accurate. Hopefully, the crime lord's data on the defenses and patrols was as accurate. Chameleon didn't have the firepower to take on a warship except by complete surprise. It would make their life a lot easier if the 2-day gap they'd found in the patrol schedule actually existed.
Fighter launch commencing now, the tactical officer announced crisply, and Kyle turned his attention back to the matter at hand.
10 Cataphract D starfighters shot into space, engines lighting off as soon as they were 20 kilometers clear of the ship and assuming a loose formation, heading away from the Q-ship. A second flight of 10 starfighters followed, then a third, and then a final flight of a mere 5 spacecraft, a permanent reminder of Chameleon's fighter losses in New Edmonton.
All fighters are running clean and clear, Commander Rokos, Taylor told the CAG. I'm reading 500 Gs across the board. No concerns showing in the pulse patterns or exhaust signatures.
Thank you, Commander, Rokos replied. Now could I pretty please have some target drones?
Shaking his head, Kyle made a go-ahead gesture to Taylor.
165 new playmates heading your way, she told Rokos.
Play rough if you need to, Cag, but remember, that's it. We don't have any more.
All squadrons, this is the Cag,
he announced over the channel as Kyle listened in.
See the spread of toys falling out of the cargo hatch? Give them about 2 minutes to get clear of Chameleon, and then we get to go play. I'm designating two for each of you, he continued. Hunt them down and take them out with the new lances. I have full interlocks turned on, but play carefully anyway. This is a test. We don't want to lose anyone.
Full interlocks had to be physically activated before the fighter left the flight deck and basically acted as reverse IFF. If the positron lance wasn't pointing at something tagged in the system as a target, it would not fire. The courses Taylor had programmed into the drones would also help reduce the risk of friendly fire, but they were running a weapons test in the middle of nowhere. Everything they could do to reduce risks was a good thing.
Your assessment, Commander?
Kyle asked as they gathered in Chameleon's conference room several hours later.
I know we prefer to replace the entire starfighter, Rokos noted gruffly, but those upgrade kits are effective tech. We found a few glitches that Hans's crews are working through as we speak, but while none of the fighters were glitch-free, all are combat-capable.
You'd be prepared to back them against scimitars.
The scimitar was never a particularly effective starfighter, the Cag pointed out. It served well against single systems and second-rate powers who didn't have comparable fighter tech. They couldn't go one-to-one with our old Cobras, let alone the Falcons and the rest of the 7th-gen birds. The League, on the other, has its notorious collection of issues. The people at New Athens Arms who designed the Cataphract and the Hoplite actually had more combat hours to analyze for their designs than we did. The broad-shouldered pilot shrugged.
In many senses, the Hoplite is a better starfighter than the Cobra, almost closer to our 7th-gen ships. The Cataphract D is roughly comparable to the Cobra once the upgrades are in, and everyone in my wing has flown Cobras.
Good, Kyle concluded. A thought and an unnecessary gesture brought up a three-dimensional hologram of the Aurelius system in the middle of the conference room. With no habitable worlds, nothing even worth the effort of terraforming, the only reason the binary system had ever even been visited was to investigate the Aurelius pair, two tidally locked gas giants, close enough that they were forever exchanging atmosphere. That had been a sufficient astronomical curiosity to get the system a name and a few initial expeditions. The unspoken hope that perhaps the pair had created an environment hospitable to human life had been proven rapidly wrong,